Yeah, I got it done. In fact, that's my story for when you ask about what was the best thing that happened this week.
I'm not going to ask you that today. Not many people get to play around with the great Mike Williams, but I do.
I'm easy.
We all know that, but what we really want to, what we're really asking ourselves is, oh dear.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast. My name is Beres Bartlett, and I'll be your host tonight, coming from the studios of the Gospel Revolution right here in Nashville, Tennessee, Music City, USA. And here for your mystical delight and listening pleasure is the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, right from the Gospel Revolution headquarters in Houston, Texas, Mr. Michael Williams. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Beres Bartlett.
I got a last name, and you got a last name.
You just got yours, though.
Yes. I don't know what to do with it. I'm like a boy with a new toy.
I know. Goodness gracious. If you learn anything that I've learned about having a last name, it can be a curse, too.
Is there a curse of the Williams, like...
The curse of the Williams.
Yes, there are people that they hear the last name Williams and it's like, uh-oh.
Is that like heads go round 180 degrees spinning like the Hound of the Baskervilles and all that?
Oh, maybe not that bad, but they definitely can have some negative reactions. You know, the one thing I can say about my brother and my sisters, even though I'm not sure what they think about me, they are all really wonderful people. They really are. They're good people.
So the curse of the Williams only touched down on you, did it?
Just me, yes.
Webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself and God and God and you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
How'd your week go, Michael?
It's a good week. It's been absolutely gorgeous in Houston. Here I am promoting people moving to Houston again. Here we are in November, and it's just been the most beautiful weather. It's mid-70s and bright and sunny and calm and just been gorgeous outside.
Mate, do you ever get snow down there?
Every few years. Now, when you say there's been snow in Houston, usually that means you wake up and there's a little dusting on the roofs, and by the time the sun comes up, it's all gone. So you have to be up early to see snow, if it does snow in Houston. So.
Gospel Revolution.
Well, tonight we're asking you, Michael, to walk us through chapter 15 of your book, One, The Gospel According to Mike. And I wanted to simply start with this quotation. It comes from Hezekiah chapter 6, verse 1, and it says, "For God shall help those who help themselves."
You silly man. That's 1 Beres chapter 1, verse 4.
Hang on. Chapter 1, did you say?
Yeah. There it is, see?
Dang. You're good. You're very good.
I know.
All right, then. I can't kid you with that. But the other day, Jay Carney, our honorable press secretary for the White House, when somebody asked him about something, he said, "As the Bible says, God helps those who help themselves." It's one of those institutionalized things. We don't. I mean, it's so ingrained. Here's the real quote I wanted to start with. It comes out of chapter 15, "The Manifold Grace of God." Here you wrote, "Everybody in Christianity pretty well knows what grace is. The problem is just where they believe it is appropriated." And when I read that, it reminded me of this, God helps those who help themselves, simply because we still believe that grace is a deserved thing. We somehow work to get grace. I mean, if you don't want to help yourself, mm-hmm. you don't deserve any grace. And
right.
That's a heck of a quote you write in there.
Yeah, it really is. And what an oxymoron to talk about grace as something that you have to qualify for, when by the essence of the fact, if you have to qualify for it, it's no longer grace, which is Paul's point that he brings out so wonderfully, that grace is no more grace. If it's law, then it's not grace. If it's grace, then it's not law. And if it's not law, it's grace. And if it's not grace, then it's law. And he's pretty thorough in his comments there. So it really is quite odd that people would have any terms of thinking that you can do anything to qualify for grace, including belief, because grace is beyond belief.
You start this chapter, Michael, with a story, and when I heard it, I couldn't even begin to understand the emotional clamor that was happening in you at the time that this story happened. Would you like to share that with us?
Yes, that was, my goodness, the story of my meeting Jack Stewart, the author of The Legalist, the only book that I had ever read that contained any understanding that I was beginning to get about grace, the difference between grace and law. So I wanted to find out more about Jack Stewart, and I found out that he was from Indianapolis, and within the next 5 minutes, I was on the phone with his wife. I was so excited. I explained to her the impact of the book. This was so powerful to me. And she told me that Jack was very ill. And I wanted to find out if they had more books, because I couldn't find them anywhere. And she said, yes, they did have a couple of cases. I asked her if I could come over and visit Jack and get the books. And she said she wasn't sure that he would be up to a visit, but I was welcome to come over and she would get the books for me. Well, they very graciously invited me in, and I was not prepared for what I saw. Jack was very ill. He was in a recliner, struggling to breathe even, the best I remember. And I sat down to talk with him and was telling him how grateful I was that he had written this wonderful, wonderful book. And he was struggling to talk to me, and he became emotional. And he said, I should never have written it. And he was in tears, and there was a lot of anguish there. So I continued to press in and let him know, Jack, if it helped just me, I still thank you so much for doing this. I didn't stay very long, and his wife went and got the books for me. And before I left, they asked if I would pray for him. This was a lot of years ago, and by then I had certainly come to the conclusion my prayers were not going to help anybody. I wasn't sure that nobody's would, but I knew for sure mine wouldn't. But this man had had such an impact on me, and I loved him deeply because of the impact of his book in my heart and in my mind. Then to find him in that condition, and it was really a very indescribable moment for me. So they asked me to pray. I certainly wasn't going to decline, but it was the first time that I prayed with full awareness that nothing's going to happen. All the times I'd prayed before, Barris, I went all the way from absolutely convinced this person is going to respond immediately to all the phases from there, which took years to arrive at a point where that I'm praying for a man knowing beyond the shadow of a doubt nothing is going to change for this man because I lay hands on him and pray for him. And I walked out of the house, and the collision that was going on in my mind was, I couldn't even describe it. Jack's suffering was unacceptable to me. This man who had helped me to at least see that someone else on this planet understood something about the difference between law and grace. It was an amazing, amazing thing. And then to get there and then have him in such anguish physically, mentally, and emotionally, and saying he wished he had never written the book. And I remember getting out in my van, and there was such an explosion taking place inside of me. I was trying to suppress it because I was almost afraid of the intensity of what was happening inside of me. And I started up the van, and I started to drive, and this horrible anguish and grief. I was angry with God. I was angry that I was risking my entire life to pursue this understanding of grace. I was heartbroken for Jack Stewart and his family to see his daughter there, heartbroken for her father, and the wife of this man there, not knowing herself whether or not he should have written this book, probably. And all of this just came to a cataclysmic moment. My mouth opened, and these screams of grief came out of me. Screams of grief and anger. And my body began to flail back and forth, slamming against the seat, my fist pounding on the steering wheel, and I pulled off to the side, and it was cataclysmic for me. So during the middle of all of this rage, grief, anger, disappointment, confusion, I can't put enough tags onto this to explain to you what was going on inside of me. I was angry that Jack Stewart was not healed when I laid hands on him. I was angry that I knew he wouldn't be before I ever prayed for him. In the middle of this extreme moment of emotion, and this is what I heard in my heart, you have received enough grace to understand that I do not judge you based on what you do and do not do. When will you receive the grace to not judge me based on what I do and don't do? And I went from a moment, now, it's up for anyone's definition. I don't try to figure those things out. It's just something that occurred in my heart. And in a split second, I went from this intense storm of emotion to absolute peace, and still almost unable to breathe because of the gush of everything coming to my face. And I sat there in absolute silence. And it was a transformative, the whole evening was so transformative for me. And I sat there, and these verses started running through my head, you know, about God's work and about how that the children of Israel had judged him. And I had never even thought about the children of Israel judging God, but they did. He says, they tried me, they proved me. They were judging God is what they were doing. And suddenly I saw that. I'd never seen it by reading it, but I knew it suddenly in my heart. So it was a very powerful moment. From that point, I ceased judging God. And what God did or did not do, would or would not do, just suddenly became absolutely irrelevant. And of course, after that, my conclusions were that everything that God had to do was accomplished at the cross.
As we're recording this, it's Thanksgiving Day in America. So happy Thanksgiving Day to all of our American friends. And to those of you who don't know what Thanksgiving is, it's kind of like Christmas on steroids. So too bad, I guess. Now, were you aware that we have just released Gospel 101 as a PowerCast? I believe Michael released it in the last week, and if you check it out, you'll be able to download it for absolutely free. Now, we were charging for this CD prior to this, but you can download it for free and put it on CDs and hand it out to all of your friends. Probably, well, certainly in my personal opinion, it is one of the best tools in the gospel repertoire. If you want to share this gospel of grace and peace with your friends,
Download it now. You could send it to your friends as an email attachment, or you could throw it onto a CD, a burner on a CD, and hand them out like that. CDs are only 50 cents a piece. So you're saving a lot of money and getting the word out. Grab yours now. Go to www.gospelrevolution.com. Go to our podcast area, and you'll see it there just in the last couple of PowerCasts. So dig in, fill your boots, and make hay while the sun shines.
Gospel Revolution.
Michael, did I tell you I found one of those books, The Legalist by Jack Stewart? I found it up on Amazon.
Oh, really? Wonderful.
But the news gets better. Today I Googled, I didn't Google it. I went to Amazon and I did a search again for it because I found this book and I was sent this book about 4 months ago. And I noticed they still have them up there for one penny a piece. You can buy the whole book for a penny and just pay, I think I paid $5 or $6 to get it shipped to my door. So I think it comes out of Texas somewhere. But it's a secondhand bookstore, and my copy's like I just bought it new. It's wonderful.
Oh, amazing. Well, people better go on there and get them because I just may go buy all of them. So,
now, Michael, there is one thing that we can do with grace that you don't seem to have touched yet. We've spoken about falling from grace. We've spoken about failing of grace, and we've spoken about trying to fix God's grace or better yet, insulting God's grace, doing despite to the Spirit of grace. But in Galatians 2.21, I find a very interesting verse. It says, Paul talking, I don't frustrate the grace of God. How do you frustrate the grace of God?
Well, really the term frustrate has the meaning to just violate, to neutralize, or to set aside. Is the direct translation. I don't set aside the grace of God. I don't neutralize it. But you can neutralize grace, obviously. Now, you can't neutralize what grace has done between God and man, but you can neutralize what grace has the ability to do in you as an individual.
Hold on, let me just get that straight again. I can't alter or change what grace does between God and man. But I can have an effect on how it affects me.
How it affects me. Legalism on the brain is just not a good combination. It just isn't. It is. It's a very dastardly combination for the new creation, for sure, because we're created in Christ Jesus. You're not created to function or operate on law. Like taking a fine piece of machinery that runs on the highest quality of gasoline and throwing crude oil in the tank. It just doesn't work. It's going to really gum up the works, if you will. It's not going to run right. You're going to wonder why nothing goes right, why all of this doesn't work. You feel as though you are equipped to have your mind and your emotions to function in some realm of sanity, but it just seems that it's not going to happen. Well, that's, I believe, the greatest influence to that insanity, and my emotions and my mind just won't come together, is the infusion of the law. This is this frustration of God's grace. And Paul said, I don't set aside the grace of God. His whole comment was, I do not frustrate. I do not set aside. I don't make the grace of God without effect in my life. For if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. This has so much in it, especially when you consider Paul's testimony. Paul's testimony was not about leaving behind murder. His testimony in Philippians chapter 3, his testimony, especially there, he gave his testimony three times in the New Testament, but his testimony was never about how he used to be a murderer. His testimony was about how he had to give up law to know Christ. He actually stated clearly that if someone is under the law, you cannot really know Christ. Because he said, I gave up my righteousness that I may know him and the power of his resurrection. Here is the influence of grace on the human mind. It's to cause all of this to work in its optimum way. But it's nothing less than the full implementation of the power of God. And it's for our mind. All the gospel is good news. It is nothing more and nothing less than the power of God. How can you know Jesus? How can you know the power of his resurrection? The only thing I can suggest is that you rid yourself of every ounce of law in your life, rid yourself of every degree of self-righteousness, because if somebody wants to know the Lord, Paul, he said, I got to get rid of law in my life. I have to get rid of self-righteousness. As Paul is making this comment here that I do not frustrate the grace of God, Paul did know people who did frustrate the grace of God, obviously. He's saying, I don't do it. And he's encouraging everyone that would read this, of course, not to do that. And when you realize the implications of frustrating the grace of God is to never truly know Christ. It is to never truly know the power of his resurrection. Now, I cannot tell you what the full knowledge of Christ will do in one's life. I cannot tell you what the full understanding of the resurrection from the dead will do in someone's thinking. But I can tell you what will bring it. And that is the absence of legalism, the absence of adding any rule, any law to relationship with God at all. A lot of people call me the unteacher. Now, that's kind of an odd thing. You know, I felt like a 7-Up for a little while, you know. I was the un-cola. But they say it's the un-teacher. So what do I un-cola? You know, what do I un-teach? Basically, what I do is I un-teach the law. I put the law in its proper perspective where that God gave it, and I hold it in its highest esteem. I think I hold it in higher esteem than anyone who teaches the law, because you can't teach the law for righteousness and hold the law in high esteem at the same time. You have to become selective about the law. I accept all that the law condemns. I make no excuses. Listen, all you shellfish eaters, you are condemned. I am so sorry. I really hate to let you know, but if you eat shellfish, you are unclean in the eyes of God. See, I don't try to change that.
So you don't try to split it up into the sacrificial law, the moral law, the ceremonial law? Is that what you're saying? Because okay, so we follow today. We like to try and follow the moral law, thou shalt not kill, but we're not real certain about the ceremonial law. Let's go kill a sheep to get right with God, and we certainly aren't all that good with the let's not eat pork and shellfish.
Yes, absolutely.
So what you're saying is you uphold the lot and enforce the lot.
Well, I uphold the lot. God enforced the lot, and he enforced it to its death. You see, the only way the law can be enforced is through death. Obedience to the law does not satisfy the law. Death is the only thing that satisfies the law.
Now, you've made that statement, I don't know, maybe over the course of this book companion series, you've made that statement possibly every second PowerCast. Could we explore that a bit more, that obedience doesn't answer the law, that death
Yes.
answers the law? And just before you do, I'd like to read Galatians 2:19. Now, the thing about the King James Bible is this. It did us a great service in italicizing those words that the translators put in to make it more understandable, and hence we can take them out also and read it almost like the original text. But in some cases where a preposition is tacked onto a noun or a verb or something, you don't find that that's italicized, because part of it was in and part of it was just added to try and help us to understand. Now, this verse 19 is a great example. And when you read it, in the Greek it says, dia nomos apotnesko nomos zalphios. And that simply means dia nomos, through the law, apotnesko nomos, I die to the law, or the law is dead as far as I'm concerned, zalphios, so that I can live God. There is no unto in the original language. It isn't in there. So it simply, if we just say it in English, it simply means this. I, through the law, have become dead to the law so that I could live God. Not that I might live unto God. Unto is a word that was added. Even though it may not be italicized. So he says, for I, through the law, am dead to the law that I might live God.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my. Yes, that's fantastic, Barris. And that is the true understanding of the law, that I, through the law, am dead to the law, thus bringing out the clarity that the only satisfaction of the law was death. The fulfillment of the law is death, not obedience, because the law was given in the most strategic way to make sure that no one could obey it. The law was given as a revealer, not a producer of even sin. The law never made a man a sinner. So the law never made a man a sinner. The law couldn't make a man righteous. So what in the world are we doing with the law? If it can't, it couldn't even make me a sinner. People were already sinners. The law never made a man a sinner. The law never made a man righteous. Then we've got to look at this implication of what the law was given for.
Does the law allow me to measure myself, I don't know, against other people?
Well, the law was never given to measure ourselves against each other. Paul said anybody that does that is stupid.
Stupid. So why do we do it all the time?
Because we're stupid. That's why.
Stupid. You crack me up, Williams. You crack me up. I'm sorry. I just go off and interrupt you like that.
No, it really is. Let's just take Paul's instruction about what the law can't be used for. If we just took the one instruction that said the law can never be used to judge somebody else, the law can only be used to judge yourself. That's in Romans. I'll let you go back and look it up for yourself. Be a good search. You cannot use the law to judge somebody else, because the moment, this is how intricate the law is, the moment I use the law to judge you, I have broken the law. Even if I've kept all of the law, which I can't and no one can, the moment I use it to judge you, I have broken it in its entirety. Paul said that I, through the law, have become dead to the law that I might live God. And Barris, isn't that what this is all about? We're living God. We're living out God on the earth. The life of God is being lived out in human beings at this moment. We must do all that we can do to help eradicate the false assumption of an out there God being out there. God decided to move in here. He's not in here and out there. He's just in here.
Are you telling me that you have an alien living on the inside of you that's trying to break out?
Well, the nice thing is he's far from alien. He's one with me. I mean, alien is something that is it's not one with you and is contrary to you. And the fact of it is God is one with me. The thing that is alien in me is the law. That's the alien. That's the alien that needs to be gotten rid of. That is the force that is going to destroy my life. If anything is going to destroy me, it's going to be the law. The thought in the Christian community that there is somehow a delicate balance between law and grace that causes relationship with God to work. You're not going to find a Christian that does not have that concept of adding some law. And this is all worked out in between each and every Christian's ears. There is no handbook on it. And in light of this very powerful verse that you brought out, I through the law am dead to the law. What a powerful statement. I through the law am obedient to the law. I through the law am righteous. I through the law, what is this? What do we get out of the law? I, through the law, am dead to the law. I could repeat that for the rest of this PowerCast and not say it enough. I, through the law, am dead to the law. I, through the law, am dead to the law. Do you see why I love the law? Because it's through the law then I'm dead to the law.
So this is why you keep all the law as one big whole rather than trying to subdivide it up into the Ten Commandments and the Jewish ceremonial and so forth.
Absolutely, because the only way that you're going to be dead to the law is through all of the law. It must be held in its whole to have its very powerful effect of eliminating itself. It is a self-eliminating law. It disqualifies itself.
So the law pretty well snookered itself.
Yes, absolutely. It put itself on a path of being terminated. And here we are trying so hard to raise the law from its death. I'm dead to it. It's dead to me. The law was the one we were formerly married to. And now we're dead to the law. The first is dead, and we are married to another, which is Christ. And when you try to serve the law, you're trying to serve a dead husband.
Is that like a widow who loses a husband and lives, dresses in black, and lives that way for the rest of her life? Because
No, it's not like a widow dressing in black. It's like a widow dressing her husband and setting him at the breakfast table, and he's dead. It's like her fixing scrambled eggs. It's like her new husband is there, but she keeps propping up her dead husband at the head of the table, and she keeps serving scrambled eggs because that's the way her dead husband liked his eggs. Well, her new husband likes over easy. He doesn't like scrambled, but she'll never please new as long as she's trying to please the old. The old is dead, and it's time to bury the sucker. Let's get him out of there and give his chair to somebody else.
Oh, what a picture. I want to go, ew.
We should also ew to having any degree of law in our lives. We really should go, ew, this is gross. Many times, Barris, I've tried to help people understand the involvement of law and grace by asking this question. Well, okay, so since there is a need for a little law to be added to God's grace, then it would also be necessary to add at least one drop of the blood of a goat to the blood of Christ to make sure that it works. And of course, that's the reaction that I get from people is, ew, that's gross to think about adding the drop of a blood of a goat to the blood of Jesus, to think that it would cause the blood of Jesus to be more effective. It is just as ignorant to add any law to God's grace, thinking that it's going to help grace. No, it's quite the opposite. If there's any law there, there's no grace. If there's the blood of a goat there, there is no blood of Jesus. These subjects must remain absolutely separate. And I, through the law, have become dead to the law. What a powerful statement that I might live God. And it is true. Thank goodness that you looked at that. And it's so powerful to read these things just straight out of the Greek or the Hebrew, exactly for what they say. For I, through the law, am dead to the law that I might live God. Oh, man, that's powerful.
Now, David says, blessed is the man that God makes righteous who has not done anything right. I mean, this turkey has done everything wrong. And David says, well, blessed is that guy that God makes righteous, even like that. And blessed is the man to whom God will not count sin against him anymore. What's David saying here?
David's saying that there is a blessedness that exists for the human race that we now have found in Christ, and that is that sin is not held against us, that righteousness is imputed. Paul quotes this, actually, in his teachings. And, of course, Jesus is called Son of David. And so this powerful revelation that David got, this is why David loved God's law. You see, it was God's law that gave him that conclusion. God's law taught David, wow, I get it. Blessed is the man that God makes righteous without doing right, and blessed is the man to whom God does not hold sin against him or count it against him. Do you see that that revelation could only have come to David through the law? That by David's absolute love for the law, his sincerity to the law, his commitment to the law, through the law, he got a revelation of the grace of God.
Well, the only other thing it could be for David, the murderer, David the adulterer, David the, let's go on with the list. The only other thing it could be is wishful thinking.
I don't think it was wishful thinking. I think it was a revelation. And by virtue of the fact that Paul brings the quote in as he was trying to explain the grace of God, he quotes this. This was a revelation for David. This was the insight that he gained by being a man that not only was under the law, but he loved God's law. I think this verse really explains why I love God's law so much, is because that it has a complete revelation of the righteousness of God. It reveals sin. It reveals righteousness. It reveals that the problem can't be what I'm doing. The problem has to be what I am.
So if that wasn't a revelation by David, maybe it was just wishful thinking, given the fact that he'd done so much wrong.
No, Barris, it wasn't wishful thinking. It was a relief. And isn't that what truth always does? It brings relief.
Need a friend? We'll be your friend on Facebook. Look us up under Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Go on, do it now.
Welcome.
Listen in your office, in your car, or even your neighborhood bar. You can listen with your whole family.
Now, we've heard about how you can offend God's grace. So how do you offend the law? Do you offend the law by breaking it?
No, the only way that you can really offend the law is to add a little grace to it. Paul has made that very, very, very clear. This is the shame on the part of Christianity by taking just part of the law and applying it to whichever denomination accepts this part of the law and does not with the other, because you're mixing a little bit of grace with God's law. When you say, yeah, you know, well, God hates divorce, but God understands and blah, blah, blah. You see, you're adding grace to law. Now, it's not so that we can condemn people that are divorced. It's so that we can understand, even as David got it, because he did not separate the law. He did not add any grace to law. When you don't add grace to law, you get an understanding of grace. When you don't when you don't add law to grace, you get an understanding of grace. So you see, both ways were designed to give us an understanding of grace. You don't want to add any law to grace because it keeps grace from being grace. And you don't want to add any grace to law because it still, once again, blocks the revelation of sin and it blocks the revelation of grace.
Michael, I want to read a paragraph. This is a rather long quote from this chapter, and it reads this way. Under the law, there is nothing but wrath. Under the law, there is reapplication of the blood. Under the law, if you break one law, you broke them all. People have offended God's law and reduced it to a Pharisaical view. That's why Jesus' teaching ministry was so poignant and misunderstood. He taught the law the way it was intended to be taught. He didn't add any grace to law. Jesus should have been the last teacher and preacher of the law. In fact, Isaiah said he came to make his law honorable. He let the law be the law. He let you know it's not only if you do it, it's even if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no grace offered in that at all, is there?
No. I remember the first time that I dropped that on a congregation. I was speaking in a church, and I made the comment that if you want to lose all hope of salvation, if you want to lose all hope that you might possibly go to heaven, then if you read the teachings of Jesus and you accept them for what they say, you will lose all hope of having any relationship with God at all. Jesus made comments that we would be judged by every word that comes out of our mouth. Goodness, he said that we couldn't be forgiven by God until we had forgiven everybody. How can you give away something you don't have? A human being offering forgiveness that he doesn't have. This is the impossibility of the law. This is the completeness of the law. To say you must forgive so that God can forgive you. Well, that's not the way, thank God, it took place. I now am able to forgive because I have been forgiven.
You're able to give away what you already have.
That's all I do. That's all forgiveness is offering what I got. So I'm going to give to him that asks.
Now, we talk about giving to get, and we are often talking about part of modern Christianity's thrust of sowing and reaping. You give and you'll get. You'll get a great harvest. But isn't that forgiving in order to be forgiven? Isn't that the ultimate giving to get?
Well, yeah, you could say that for sure, and on all levels. You know, that's the thing about the law. Every one of them is the ultimate, you know. The law is so amazing. It's the ultimate. In everything that it declares, it is the ultimate. But it is true. Trying to give what we don't have is the conclusion of the law. You're going to try to do what you don't have. You're going to try to give what you don't have. Now, Paul evidently got this himself. He understood it because after the cross, Paul said that you and I should forgive one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven us. Well, Paul disagreed with Jesus. So who are we going to believe, Paul or Jesus? This is not one that we have to choose one between the other. We have to accept the one who was teaching under the first covenant and the one who was teaching under the last covenant. Because it is true, under the law, the only way you can get forgiveness from God is to forgive everybody.
Hey, Mike, did you ever see the movie Schindler's List?
Yes, I did.
Heck of a movie.
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times, actually.
All black and white. Not bad for a black and white movie, huh?
That's true. I'd forgotten that it was all in black and white.
Except for just a couple of scenes, and the most poignant of which was a little girl in a red coat. And you can go, you can Google it and just see these scenes on your own computer. And the remarkable thing is it was a work of art the way that Spielberg produced and directed this movie, because this little girl, innocence on two legs, in a red coat, she was against a backdrop of jack boots and chevrons and caps and everything that was army, everything that was German, all these soldiers. And it was against this backdrop some would say this backdrop of hatred, or this backdrop of...
be a backdrop of evil.
Of evil, yeah. That this little girl, this innocence on two legs in a red coat, was seen. Now I want to quote this single sentence from this chapter. The law is a beautiful backdrop to God's grace.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And without the conclusion of the law, we don't have the background to be able to see grace. That's why it's so important to leave the law intact. You know, the very first thing that an artist does is, set the base color down so that we will be able to see the whole picture. It is the color behind, whether it's white or whatever it is, it's that color that gives the contrast and the understanding of the entire picture is this backdrop to the painting itself. So yeah, no, it's a beautiful picture, and I think that the picture from that you've brought back to us from Schindler's List is an excellent portrayal of that.
Hey, Mike, we got a couple of birthdays this week. We have, and I'm sure that we mustn't get everyone's, but anyway. Doug Misner and Murphy Hyde, happy birthday, guys.
Happy birthday. Yes, happy birthday. My goodness, another one. Both these guys are wonderful gentlemen, and it's a good journey. You guys keep walking.
Hey, all you gospel revolutionaries, we are just so fortunate to have you as friends and companions on this journey. And whether it's your birthday or not, we're thinking of you from one end of the world to the other. And we just wish we could all be together in one big room, don't we, Mike?
Always. That's always my goal, is to get the folks together. That's a bit of a selfish motive also, because it's always such a wonderful time.
Gospel Revolution.
Michael, in this chapter, you talk about an experience you had in understanding grace, about being dunked in the oceans of the world. What was that about?
Oh my, yes, that was a wonderful experience, really. It was a bit baffling before, during, and after. But it was another one of those times where I really had a question. I wanted to understand. I was seeing grace as being something so much bigger than I could possibly express. I couldn't say it. There's no way I could say it. There's no way that I could truly put it into words. There didn't seem to be a way that my mind could fully grasp the implications of what grace actually was. And as I was trying to understand what grace actually is, I suddenly saw myself. It was like I was up over the oceans of the entire planet. Something had me by the scruff of the neck and holding me up over the oceans. And as I was just watching what was going on in my mind's eye, just this little view was taking place, and the big hand lowered me down to the surface of these kind of choppy waters, actually. And in a split second, though, in my mind's eye, I saw myself completely submerged in water. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, I'm down, uh-oh, I can't breathe. It was so fast down and back up that I had no chance to even try to take a second breath. But as minuscule of the amount of time that I was in the water, there was not a way I could have been wetter. If I would have been held under for 5 minutes, I would have been no wetter than I was by being dunked under just for the most split second. So I saw this in my mind's eye, and so in this conversation I was having, I said, so that's supposed to be my understanding of grace? Because I was wanting so much, and then I saw this little thing in my mind, and I said, so that's how I'm to understand grace? And then this was what I heard in my heart, that the amount of grace that I had experienced was like the amount of water that it took to get me wet. The amount of grace that is available is like the amount of water that's left in the oceans of the world. Now, I was stupefied by the comparison, and it was like, gee, thanks. Yeah, you really gave me a way to understand this. It's like, I was hoping for something a little more in a context that I could understand, but it really is that magnificent, the oceans of grace that are available to anyone. I'm not talking about the grace that it took to get us redeemed. I'm talking about the grace that is understood in the preaching and understanding of the gospel, the oceans of God's grace. And I'll guarantee you that no matter how much you understand the grace of God, there's oceans of grace out there still yet.
Baby dragon, so tall, sweet. Well, mate, what do you got on this week? Anything else lined up? Or just another week in beautiful Houston?
No, for this week. I know one thing. You didn't ask me your question.
So what was the most interesting thing that happened to you this week, Michael?
Yeah, you know what? If you start feeding the dog a treat every day at a certain time, you know, he expects it again. I mean, you feed me this treat, and then all of a sudden you try to take it away from me. And this time I was ready for you. Jeez.
Well, come on, cough it up. What was it?
I'm not telling you.
Hey, did you ever hear about the sadist and the masochist?
I don't know if I want to. What was it?
The sadist says, spank me. And the masochist says, no.
Well, I think my story is better than that one. Actually, I will tell you. I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to tell everybody else. Yeah, this week was I had a very interesting thing that happened that I think everyone will appreciate.
Okay, okay, that's it for the show this week.
Back off, Bear. this was just such a really sweet thing. I think everyone knew from last week that I had another car expense. That was almost $500. It's still cheaper than buying another car, but it's rapidly getting to the point where that it's not. So another $500. And I honestly didn't have a way to pay it. I could pay most of it by putting, part of it on two different cards and, that I had enough space on to put this on. But there was just another $100. I just couldn't come up with the other $100. There is, Linda and Robert Parks in Alabama have been friends of mine. Oh, I don't even know how long. It's going on 2 decades for sure. And tremendous impact that the Gospels had on their lives. They've been supporters for forever and ever. But what Linda likes to do is to, on occasion, she puts a $100 bill in the mail and sends it off to me. I never know when it's going to happen. She does it occasionally. And I'm sitting there on the couch, and so I'm trying to figure out where in the world am I going to get another $100 from? And all of a sudden it just hit my brain, Linda! And, so I get up, I put everything down, from my desk, and I go to the mailbox. Now, I have no reason to really think that this would be there because, you know, she does this, on occasion. But certainly not every week by any means. So I ran out to my mailbox and opened the box, and I saw it laying there with the return address on it, Linda Parks. And I thought, yes, yes, Linda, thank you, thank you, thank you. So I got my $100 bill out. I took my two credit cards with me, and I went to pick up my car, which was being held hostage in lieu of payment. And the first thing that I did is lay down the $100 bill, and I said, now how much do I owe you? And the rest of it we divided up between two credit cards. So, yes, that was a wonderful experience, even though you were not interested in me telling it.
Is that it? Is it over yet?
Yes, it's over.
Oh, we love to hear these inside stories of the life and times of Michael Williams. We would not be complete without them.
Somehow I think life would be complete without them.
Hey, listen, you had the flu last week. Have you still got it?
No, it never was the flu. Here I am having to correct you again. I never had the flu, Barris. You're trying to make this a great testimony. I know where you're going with this.
Because I prayed for you. You shouldn't be better now. I prayed for you.
Well, but see,
I prayed for that money too, mate. That was me, you know.
You were praying for a cold. So, I mean, you were praying for the flu and I didn't have the flu. So how effective could your prayers be? You have to ask specifically. Haven't you ever heard that if you're going to ask, you must ask specifically?
No, I prayed for the flu for you. Have you got it yet?
No, and you don't get your prayers answered anyway, so I'm not worried. But, no, I am feeling much better. Yes. I went to the aid of some friends who needed my help, and, one of them was sick, and, they bestowed upon me, this reward. So I got the reward for the efforts of my labors.
They blessed you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. No.
Okay. And so, folks, it is that we must leave you. This is Barris Bartlett, your host from Nashville, Tennessee, saying thanks for joining us. And we've really enjoyed putting this together this week. Hope that you've enjoyed it as much as we have. And
this is Michael Williams coming to all of you with a very grateful heart, grateful that you are a part of my life personally and a part of the gospel revolution. You guys make all the difference in the world. Thank you so much.
And so next week, same time, same channel, where we'll be back to do exactly the same thing again, only
better.
Keep a dragon to exist. You rely on the ones that you enlist. Ironically, we're your ventriloquist. But now I've learned to think. It's got me wondering, why did we ever give a voice to something that's extinct? Cause you've been scaring the world with your stature, clouding our day with your gloom, and filling our minds with your poison, preaching your message off to paper dragons. Oh, paper dragons. Well, we are walking out mission aboard. We're pulling out our life support. It's all over, paper dragon. I'll see you on the ground. I'll see you on the ground. I'll see you on the ground.
Well, that one last week, though, turned out absolutely superb, so it may have been more difficult, but goodness gracious, what a wonderful show. What a wonderful, wonderful show.
That's my, look, very, without trying to be poetic or wax any way whatsoever, that's my goal. My goal is, can we get this message out in the most persuasive and simple and effective manner? If we can do that. And we were dealing in the last three ones, we were dealing with topics that you hardly ever... If I went to most sermon sites, I don't think I would easily find any sermons on these three topics.
No, you would not. Believe me. I looked for them desperately before I ever started teaching on the grace of God or the gospel of peace. And when these were just thoughts in my head, and I just knew that there had to be a book somewhere, I knew that others had written on it, and they had not. It just did not exist.
Is it always like this around here, Mildred?
Always. Oh, and it's so embarrassing.
No, I love it. It reminds me of home.